is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Karen Ivanoff, cultural anthropologist for Lake Clark National Park. You can view Karen's slideshow, including music and photos from the community of Nadalton, on our website, alaskapublic.org. Her talk, entitled Dena Ana Alena, A Celebration, A Window into Dena Ana Culture, was recorded on October 16th at the Bioneers in Alaska Annual Conference held at UAA.
So Karen is from the Dena Ana Athabaskan tribe. She was born and raised in the Lake Clark region. She's a cultural anthropologist and works for the Lake Clark National Park. She has worked extensively in cultural resource preservation, particularly concentrating on imparting traditional ecological knowledge to various programs. And this has included incorporating traditional ecological knowledge into the state-approved quality assurance program template, which is part of the Tribal Water Quality Program. She has worked extensively with the UAF Oral History Department, collecting oral history from villages prior to contact, and has presented most recently on the Dena Ana and Federal Partnership to Protect the Chulitna River Six-Mile Lake Watershed, which is a keystone cultural landscape. So I'm happy to introduce Karen, and welcome.
Thank you. You may have noticed she said Dena Ana instead of Dena Ana. In our area, the dialects, well, there's five different language groups of the Dena Ana Athabaskan culture. In Nadalton area, which is where I'm from, we say Dena Ana, which is part of our dialect. You're probably aware of the Dena Ana Center here in Anchorage downtown. A lot of people pronounce that Dena Ana, which is part of the Iklutna dialect. So I'd just like to start by thanking the committee who invited me. Thank you for this opportunity to present today, to Colleen Labert especially. So I'm going to start my presentation before I get into the PowerPoint. And I'm a little bit nervous, so bear with me. I'm gonna talk about labels and names just to introduce you to my perspective and my worldview as part of the Dena Ana culture. As I looked over the conference agenda, I saw key themes like sustainability, local farming, wilderness survival, living that empowers us, bridging the ancestral ways, living in balance, solutions and strategies. A lot of titles and labels, and when I reflect on each one, they all steer me to the same place, a place of coming home to nature. I thought about how I can make what I have to say fit into these themes and realize it's all the same message. When I speak about caring for place, it's about the sustainability. The meaning of place is about wilderness survival. Being out on the land is about living that empowers us and helps us live in balance. The respect and being conscious of how much we take from the land for our use is also part of that. And first-hand experience is green building. And lastly, our Dena Ana values and beliefs are about solutions and strategies. So I offer the same vision from a slightly different perspective and with a different selection of words. I also thought about the word pioneer. Not a familiar word to me. So I looked it up in the dictionary or online. There was a whole host of technical descriptions, so I went back to your flyer for this conference. One part said, what is a pioneer? Part of the paragraph said, a unique cross-cultural and global gathering of visionary innovators who work with nature to heal nature, offering an environmental solution. To add to that, I think that not only do we need to work to heal nature, but allow nature to heal us. When I'm out in nature, that is my healing. It's where I come home to myself, and it's where I feel the most at home. I grew up in a community in Nundalton, which is about 250 miles southwest of Anchorage. No road connection, about 200 people in the community, and I graduated from high school there. So we're surrounded by nature, as a lot of rural Alaska is. Okay, my dear friend and inspiration, Apila Colorado, who is the director of the Indigenous Mayan University program under Wisdom University, shared some words that relates to this and makes sense. One is that we were all Indigenous at one time. When you think about Indigenous people, most people think of Native people. In Alaska, we are considered Indigenous people. What makes me Indigenous? It may be my culture, which is Dena Ina Athabascan, and this may include my blood quantum and the way of life I've been raised in. But when you think about it, we truly have been Indigenous at one time. No matter what nationality you come from, if you were to trace your ancestry back far enough, you would find that they lived with the land at one time. So you are Indigenous. The difference today is that we, and I speak for the culture I come from, have maintained our connection to the land, the animals, and fish. We still hunt and fish and pick berries seasonally. And so I relate to the word pioneer as being Indigenous, coming back home to nature. The dictionary defines Indigenous as belonging to a place, originating in and naturally living, growing or occurring in a region or country. The second thing I pass on from Apila pertains to the word traditional knowledge or traditional ecological knowledge. When we use the word traditional, it is commonly thought of as what is in the past. Much of the knowledge I share is not of the past. A lot of it is current. So the words I choose to use when I remember is Indigenous knowledge or Indigenous science, rather than traditional knowledge. So the main, in my introduction, I was introduced as working for the Lake Clark National Park Service as a cultural anthropologist. And I just got to mention, I feel like I am in a unique position. I'm not only working from my home area, and I get to work with the culture I come from, plus surrounding communities, which I know a lot of the people in that area. But also, I'm very much supported in my work by the managers, Gene Schaaf, who's my immediate supervisor, and the superintendent, Joel Hard. And without that support, which is a lot of it supporting my perspective and my voice and how I believe projects should be run, I'd not be able to do the job I'm doing today. So the main topic I'm talking about today is the book I worked on called Dena Ina Ithlina. The slash T is a barred L, which is we have a lot of in our language. So Dena Ina Ithlina, a celebration of place. It's a story about the Dena Ina people and place names. In our belief system, we believe that all things on earth have a spirit, which the name for that is Kitnayi, which means it's speaking to you. So it's like when you look at out on the land, the trees, what's out in nature, our belief was that things are speaking to us. We need to pay respect to what's out there on the land. So the database consisted of 2,000 Dena Yena place names represented in the book. Actually, not all the names are in the book. 2,000 are in our database, and maybe half of that is in the book. The layout and themes of this book was a challenge in several ways. One was that I didn't want the words to be interpreted by an outsider. I wanted the words to stay as much as possible the way they were spoken. In this way, we capture the true voice and meaning from the people themselves. And second was to have local people tell us how they would like the words of their ancestors represented in this book. The challenge with this is that I was stepping outside the box of anthropological theory and methods. The detail involved working with a team of various resource people. There was a linguist, a number of elders, GIS technician, and one other anthropologist. And recognition goes to respected elder Andrew Baluta, who recently passed away and who I had the privilege to work with and learn from over the last 15 years. One of the things Andrew told me as we worked over the years is that some things of our culture are not meant to be written down. We need to pass this on orally, and this is one of the things we're not doing enough of anymore. This is something Tamarack Song talked about a little bit last night, telling stories and passing stories on. And in our village, we're not doing enough of that anymore. We're not talking to each other. And also, we're not acknowledging our elders enough. We're not looking to them as being the teachers in our communities. The other person who I give recognition to is Dr. James Carey, who is a linguist. He dedicated many years of work documenting Dena Yena place names and oral histories. And I have to say, with outside researchers coming in, a lot of the oral histories that have been recorded over the years, I have to say those would not be preserved if they had not been recorded. So I recognize the researchers who did come to our community and document and record this information. There was a GIS specialist, Angie Southwood, who also works for the Park Service. She was very patient in working on the maps and the database. And this work is also a good example of bridging modern technologies and indigenous knowledge. This is a picture of two elders. I couldn't find the picture of our steering committee, and this is one of my favorite pictures. Both elders have passed on, and this was at a culture camp held at the historic Kijik, which is about 20 miles from our hometown. So to assist with the local voice and perspective, a local steering committee of six people from six different communities in the Lake Clark area was formed. We met several times. What I learned at the first gathering was the importance of introducing a topic that people can relate to. We began with a story about an ancient trail used over many years and a recent walk on the trail by one of the committee members. From this story, additional memories and other stories were shared. Some were sad, some were happy, and some were humorous. There were stories about hunting and fishing, favorite places for camping, and socializing with neighboring communities. And the spiritual fulfillment of place that's not always easy to put into words. Because of the shared relationships between the people and through shared experience with the land, the conversations at this gathering and the connection were easily established. As a participant, I began to understand at a deeper level how land, story, and people are all tied. At this gathering, we reminded each other to remember the power of place and where we come from. This has been one of the most empowering processes of my work experience. It highlights the importance of staying true to my beliefs and ethics, the importance of validating and having equality in projects that write about Native people or any other cultural group for that matter. And most importantly, it gave voice to the local steering committee, which empowered them in this process. So a key topic at this discussion was the importance of the seasons and how much our lives revolve around the seasons. The seasons represent a circular calendar for the Dena'ina people. Although the people of today don't live as intimately connected with the land as before, there's still the rhythm of life that reflects the rotation of seasons. So the book is not laid out chronologically, but is presented based on the seasons. Traditional Dena'ina did not rely on the four-season calendar as we are used to. They had multiple seasonal definitions for each part of a seasonal change. An illustration of the seasonal round is given in chapter 3, and we have a seasonal circle in the book. So the middle section of the book starts out with holds the maps that are represented. And we started, one thing we wanted to do was to represent each community area and also highlight important resource areas, because there was not enough room for the number of pages for the book to include all place names. And so this revolves, the areas that are shaded represents where the names are highlighted in the book. So the place names and oral histories represented are rooted in a perspective that has unfolded through the unique use of the Dena'ina language. The majority of the stories were recorded in the Dena'ina language and translated into English. Because of this translation, some of the meaning may not be truly accurate, or the English equivalent is not always easy and easily interpreted. So this was taken on Lake Iliamna, and it represents some of the place names in the book. As you can see, some of the definition is in English revolves around water. One of them is clear areas. The one on the lower right is, and you can see the arrow pointing to, there's an area in the back of the water where it's very clear and surrounded by trees. So Lake Iliamna is about 25 miles from Lake Clark. There's a lot of information we learn from the names, which tell us about the history of place. For example, past camping areas or events that happened in different areas. It tells us a lot about environmental changes, including fish and wildlife changes over time. There are a lot of trails and trail routes. The names also represent markers for traveling, for materials like birch bark or important stones. An elder's definition of place is, everywhere you go, it brings back memories of what happened there. It's like markers of all the places and what we did. You think about what happened and who was there before you. Going to these places, it feels so good inside your heart. It makes you feel good. Through our memory, we have to pass this on. Some of the names here, there's Tanilin Vutnu, which flows into water, and it's a creek that comes down right below Port Allsworth. Chakaturat is one, is kept in the corner, and that's right across the lake there. And what this name represents is a war story. There was wars in the area, maybe between Dena'ina and Yupik people, and so this tells us the history way, you know, over 100 years ago. And one that is kept in the corner was when Dena'ina people captured someone from a nearby area. And one is kept in the corner, that person was kept in the corner. So there's a whole host of war stories that relate to some of these names. And Chakak Duthnutnu is animals walk out stream. This is where there used to be caribou that was in the area around one of the streams toward Upper Lake Clark. Okay, this is another slide of the earlier versions of the map. And Kaka, there's a There's a really important historic trail called the Tulaquena Trail, and people would trade routes coming over from Stony. It's a trading route coming over from Stony River to Lake Clark side. Stony River's near the Kuskokwim area, and one of the names, third one down, is Tionic People's Trail. So people travel a long way for trading, coming over to the Cook Inlet side to Tionic, which is another Dena Ina community. And the name on the bottom where caribou scratch horns on brush is, this was, according to oral history, this was a common stopping area for caribou, which tells us there's not a lot of caribou in that area anymore. It shows us changes over time as far as fish and wildlife resources. So this map represents land use boundaries defined from the oral histories. In the past, there was a lot of trading, like I mentioned, between communities. And part of this was allowing land use for hunting, fishing, or trapping in your defined area. There were no written rules. This was done by verbal understanding and trust. So for example, Nundalton area would trade or allow use of land in their surrounding area, say to another community, New Halen, Iliamna. They'd be able to come over and hunt and trap. So there was shared use of resources. They'd communicate with each other, and there was a clear understanding of that with the groups. This is an example of the trails I mentioned, going up through Lake Clark, all the way back to Stony River and Kuskokwim area, and over to the right to Cook Inlet side. So these trails, some of them are over 200 miles long, and these are trails only traveled by foot or dog team or with canoe on water routes. So the next three slides I'm going to show is importance of using place name as part of Western scientific studies. Place names identify important salmon spawning and migration areas. So some of the names tell us where salmon spawn, important migration routes, and this was part of a study that was done, and the places identified and lined up. So we collected the information, we looked at place names. There was a Western biological salmon study, which has been happening for a number of years, but this is in the early start of this project, and they were radio tagging where salmon were migrating and the different spawning areas. So the high use areas, the resource areas in the spawning areas totally lined up with the radio tagging that was being conducted. And when we put this together, the biologist said that if he had talked to the local people more, it would have helped him to know where to go with the radio tagging. It would have saved a lot of time. So this is an example of the importance of indigenous knowledge and science working together collaboratively with Western science projects. So I'm going to go into values here. And the next 10 slides I'm going to go through, many of the pictures are taken at fish camp. And I'm going to talk a little bit about fish camp and what that means to me. Fish camp continues to be an important tradition of the Dena Ina people. The comparison used when I'm asked what fish camp is that it's like Christmas, only better. We are not paying a price for gifts or experiencing a fleeting moment of joy and celebration. We are preparing all year long for our few months of celebration. We are coming together as family and community and sharing the gratitude of putting up fish. We're fulfilling our spirits, minds, and emotions and bodies from the same source and practices our ancestors did. It's hard to put into words the feeling, the connection that ignites the spirit when it comes time for fish camp. It is an ingrained, unconscious movement that is felt when spring turns into summer. Fish camp is a communion with every aspect of putting up fish. It's a relationship that has been created from the time of birth, sensing when summer comes, it's time to go back to fish camp. It's the smell, the slime, it's nature, it's connecting back to the water, it's bringing relatives home. It's knowing you have fish for winter, not only for your family, but to share at potlucks and with relatives and friends. It's also a spiritual igniter that restores this underlying excitement after a long winter. It's a part of life that is not questioned whether we go to fish camp or not. It's just done every summer. It's the contented labor of splitting fish, of stoking the smokehouse fire, and of taking care and pride in putting up fish the right way. This deep-rooted way of life cannot be measured, cannot be priced, and it can be easily overlooked by an outsider because it's beyond the visual and the spoken. This is the difference between being born into this way of life and learning about it later in life. The latter is a new experience. Processing salmon, which is referred to by the Dena Inna as putting up salmon for winter food, making dry fish, canning, freezing, is something people who are new to this may do if they have time or if it's something enjoyable, possibly for recreation. The connection, the familiarity, and lifelong relationship with the camp, nature, fish, and food source is there from birth and over generations for those raised in a village. Yahoch kach daltsi yiyi. We live from the outdoors. In our language, there's no name for resource. The terms in English mean what we use from the outdoors. This defines the Dena Inna people, and this knowledge is vital to the continuance of our people. I share what fish camp means to me because I've lived it. Many of the oral histories in this book represent a way of life that has changed for us. We can relate to this and pass on this knowledge by continuing to, well, I already got 5 minutes, wow. By continuing to practice it. This is not to say we are without challenges. With the modern and increase of technology, our younger generation is not practicing the values and being out on the land as much. The gap between them and nature is widening, and our elders are concerned. We had a recent first elders gathering, and the goals are to continue these gatherings and invite the youth by having seasonal camps, which we're planning a spring camp, a winter camp, winter beaver trapping camp, which we did one last winter, and then a spring camp after that. So in the last 100 years especially, we've gone through many changes. Religion, Western schools, fish and wildlife laws. And I can see how part of this suppressed us as a Dena Inna culture. A lot of this has not been passed on. We have a lot of healing to do in our area. And at a recent elders gathering, an elder said, when the schools came in, we forgot that we were the first teachers. So the changes are about healing and reconnecting with the power within. The tribal council and majority of the community are working with the Park Service on a project. And I just wouldn't feel right if I didn't mention one of the challenges in our home area, which is the Pebble Mine. Nundalton is the closest community to the potential Pebble Mine. It's just 16 miles from where the exploration is happening. And if this mine goes through, it will be the world's largest open pit mine. And the tribal council and the community did vote against this mine. And you wouldn't believe the controversy that's happening in our region because of this. It's divided communities. There's people for and against, and so it's created a big challenge already. And one of the things we're doing with the Park Service, in my position, and several others at the park, is collaborating with Nundalton Tribal Council on a project that documents important resources in the 6 Mile Lake, which is the lake Nundalton is on, up through Chilitna River, which is the back river on the back side of the exploration area. And in 2010, we collected some data, we conducted interviews, and the pictures, the slideshow that's going to be next, shows this was in the summer, some of the pictures we collected for this project. And there's several songs, you may hear a glitch between each one, but the first two are by my great uncle, and then the last few are by the contemporary Dine Ina dance group. So I'll end my presentation with the slideshow.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Karen Ivanoff, cultural anthropologist for Lake Clark National Park. You can view Karen's slideshow, including music and photos from the community of Nundalton, on our website, alaskapublic.org. Her talk, entitled Dena Ana Alena, A Celebration, A Window into Dena Ana Culture, was recorded on October 16th at the Bioneers in Alaska Annual Conference held at UAA. For the question and answer session, Karen was joined on stage by Tim Myers, owner of Myers Farms, another keynote speaker at this year's Bioneers Conference. We've divided the Q&A for broadcast purposes, but next week on Addressing Alaskans, you can hear Tim Myers' complete keynote address, along with questions from the audience.
For Ms. Ivanoff, my question, I'm really glad you addressed Pebble Mine at the end, but my specific question is, in your experience, what's the impact of Pebble Partnership being able to spend lots of money, like hiring local people in many different communities, and basically being able to come in and spend a lot of money ahead of time? How has that worked within the communities as far as some of the controversy?
So you're asking, in comparable to resources, Pebble have tons of money for the exploration and. Can you clarify?
Yeah, it's more the impact on the community. You said there was a lot of controversies within communities, so I'm curious, when they can come in and hire lots of people and basically spend a lot of community money ahead of time, how has that kind of impacted the communities? And I know it can be different in different communities, but I was just wondering what your impression is of being able to come in, a big corporation come in, and hire people, you know, because they're creating some jobs, but I believe that's a bad thing in the long run. So I was just wondering if your personal experience with some of that.
I think it's created a lot of conflict in the community, but majority, I'd say 90% of Nundalton residents are not supportive, and a lot of the people are not choosing to work for the mine, although jobs are needed, and Pebble is spending a lot of money in advertising and that sort of thing, as you've seen on the commercials. We lack resources in the area as far as speaking out, as far as understanding the process. We're not educated in the technical jargon of permitting. And so there's been a lot of visitors to the community. Pebble Groups is one of them, to talk about the process. But I think what's really missing is interpretation. People don't understand the scientific jargon as far as permitting and that sort of thing. One of the things I have to mention, that this was about a month ago, Pebble did, and I don't want to go on the Pebble bandwagon, but this is a big deal in Alaska. Pebble paid for a actor, well-known Indian native actor, to come out to the region. Wes, I don't know his last name, but Studi. They paid for him to come out. He traveled to the villages. When he came to Nadalton, the tribal council would not allow him to speak in the community building. And this was huge for them not to do that. One of the people who are kind of neutral there was, you know, he went to one of the homes there. But yeah, I hope that kind of answered your question.
Thank you.
Well, first I just want to say that I think having these two speakers, the two of you here, is really important, and having you side by side, because what I'm seeing is very important issues, two very important issues, and they sort of cross boundaries facing rural village Alaska. And there's sort of some differing cultural backgrounds, differing perspectives on things, I think. So this is kind of for both of you, but I think, Tim, regarding your project and being a pilot who's familiar with air transport and the dependency of air transport on air transport that villages have for most of their basic goods and services, how do you foresee your project shaping up as what many, many people and many analysts see as continually rising fuel costs, continually declining economy? And how do you see your production shaping up in the face of that? Because it seems very machine dependent to me. And to connect that with Karen and the Dena Ina people in all the villages, how do you foresee that dependency on the bush plane, bringing the goods and services, shaping up in the future? And to top that off, there's a lot of talk that I hear about some of the other villages embarking on their own horticultural, agricultural projects. Maybe each of you can comment on the feasibility of that. Thanks.
Just thinking about something Tamarack said last night at his talk, is that we can't go back to the past. And he said, well, if you believe that, what makes you think we're going forward? And I like that. I like, it makes sense to me, because when I look at the village I come from, I don't see a lot of going forward. I see a lot of things that have happened that is keeping us in place. And through learning the power within us, our knowledge, our indigenous knowledge, our scientific knowledge, we tap into a big resource that we're not utilizing anymore. And I think that, in alignment with some of learning from the, continuing to learn from the outside, we can't just depend on what's outside of us. We need to work together and not only tap into our own resources within us and with our in our communities, but acknowledge and embrace what we can learn from that we could bring in that can help sustain our communities, like what Tim is talking about, farming. That's huge. That could be a benefit to our community.
Individuals and collectively help you to keep those away from you so you can, you know, do what you really want to do in life instead of fighting the minds.
You know, one of the things I think about in working closely with the Tribal Council staff on several projects is the lack of resources in the office. The state exploration is happening on state land, and the people with the state have a chance to do it different. There's not been a lot of resources provided to the village. The stuff's happening in our backyard, 16 miles from our hometown. And I think what's really missing in the as far as staffing and following this process is a cultural and natural resource office with staff that understand, and that's all their job is, following this, interpreting it for the council and the local community. It could be under the tribal council umbrella, possibly. I mean, I think helping with getting funding resources to staff people there who can follow this and understand it. This would take people, scientists, you know, and I'm not sure there's many who want to live year-round in the village, but it's one area I see that's missing.
Thanks to you both for coming. Alaska and all around the Arctic is changing along with the rest of the world, the rest of the planet. And Tim, your work is, you know, astounding in a lot of ways because so many people wouldn't expect you're doing what you're doing, where you're doing it. And Karen, you and your people have been doing what they are doing right where everyone should be expecting them to be doing it, just the way you should be expected to do it. But the planet's changing, and that's going to affect all of us, but it's going to affect, you know, Pebble, if Pebble ever happens, which it won't, hopefully. And it's going to affect agriculture and every plant, every growing thing, every living thing, you know, in the Yukon, Kuskokwim Delta. So I'm just wondering, in addition to all of these political, economic, human-based things that you're dealing with, you know, energy and all of those things, what you think the planet's changing. And you can interpret that however you want. What do you think the planet's changing is going to bring to what you're doing and to your home place?
I think with the changes and development continues, Alaska is one of the last wilderness places in the United States, and if development keeps happening, if it happens, I speak for my area, we won't have a culture anymore. We met with, we had an elders gathering I mentioned a couple weeks ago, and we asked them, what if we had no more salmon? What would it be like for you? And they said, we couldn't be here anymore. We can't live without salmon. We'd have to move. So our resources in our area, our food, it's not just about resources, it's about food, it's about fulfillment, it's our culture, and without that, we wouldn't be who we are. It would bring a lot of changes.
Okay, my name is Alice, and I just wanted to say that I am not Dena, and Karen knows that, we're friends, but I grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska, and salmon has been a big part of my past. Every summer we went to a place called Chitna along the Copper River, and my dad would line us all up, about 10 of us, I'm one of 11 children, and we would dip net for salmon. And that was a very special time of my life, every summer looking forward to going and having the camping experience and being near the water and getting the fish. But I've also had the gift of being a guest at Karen's family's fish camp, and it's been in their family for generations. And when I was there, Kula was there, Tristan, and I wanted to ask Tristan what it's like to be at fish camp and what do you like about it? Being the youngest student in this room, I think do you want to stand up so people see you? Okay. I actually asked him this a little while ago. And how old are you, Kula?
Six.
And he told me, getting a little teary-eyed, that it was really important for him. He wants to be able to go there every summer. And he already understands that something might be changing, something is changing. So I don't want to speak for Kala, but I would like him to be able to go there every summer as well and bring his, you know, when he grows up, bring his family there and keep it in the family for generations. So I'm putting this out there, and I also want to compliment Karen because there's something she hasn't shared with you. She is a woman of many talents. A few years ago, she was the recipient of an Alaska Marketplace scholarship. And do you mind, Karen, if I mention this? It's a little too late, but she has a wonderful project on her. Another thing she hasn't mentioned, there's an opportunity along with all the natural resources there for people who have never had the opportunity to be in a village and observe the way of life. The salmon and the fish camp, that is the way of life. That's not separate. It's not recreational. Karen was saying some people can just go fishing if they want to or choose to. If I were Dena Inna, it sounds like that's part of who I am, being that connected to the land. It's not something out there that's just an option. And so it's really essential to the well-being of the culture and the community and the people. It's something within, not just separate. So I would love to see some kind of, I don't know, a petition or something get started, like when women were asking how to help. If there's strength in numbers, if there's any way we can collaborate with the community of Anchorage and other communities statewide and even nationwide to show our support in favor of continuing the Dena Inna culture to whatever we can do, whether it's contributing office supplies or human time or other kinds of resources to ensure that her son, Tristan, will have a chance to go to fish camp every year. What do you think? So I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you. And also ask Karen, is there a way you can imagine organizing or putting together and a way people could donate time or hours or funding to ensuring it's not even the preservation of the culture, but just ensuring the sustainability of the Dena Inna culture. I'm concerned as an anthropologist in my background. We don't want to see cultural genocide happening. It's already happened way too much on this world. So what do you think?
I wouldn't do it alone. a number of us, yeah, I can see something like that formed. I think about the Gwich'in people up north who've done a lot of work with and speaking out with in regards to possible Anwar happening up in that area, and I think we can learn a lot from them. So, yeah, and I agree, there is power in numbers.
And my question for Karen is, in your experience resisting Pebble Mine, can you tell us what you found to be the most effective and the least effective forms of resistance?
As far as least effective and most effective, I don't see a measurement there. I were a small, somebody mentioned, it's like fighting against a tsunami or a tornado, and we have a little 2x4 we're holding up against them. That's how I see it. And as far as is being effective, I feel like it's back and forth. It's like a merry-go-round. You know, we put our efforts forward, and then we get slammed back with something the other direction. So I think what's the most effective for our community, though, is that we support each other and in our efforts, and that we do look outside more aggressively for resources to help support us in these efforts.
Thank you so much for being here. This means a lot to have this sharing. In Ojibwe country, where I live in Wisconsin, we're also having an issue with a mine that is also threatening the headwater wilderness. And people are coming together, and it's the same, very similar scenario where, you know, hundreds of thousands of signatures, you know, the companies, the mining companies have so much money, and they're just bulldozing. So having an adversarial relationship is what we have practiced up until now. We've lived in a dichotomous perspective, and I think that we've talked a lot about shifting perspective. And if we can do that, rather than good against bad and, you know, the cowboys and the Indians, to really see that we are that person? What is that greed that that person has, or that need, that fear that is guiding their actions? And look inside of ourselves, where do we have those fears that lead us to greed? And really work with that within ourselves, because if everything around us is a mirror of what we really believe inside ourselves, I feel that that's a place where we can really, really make a shift. And also envisioning is such a powerful tool that we have as humans to see that the land, to see the pristine land, to see Kala. To see Kala growing up and going to fish camp, to see all of us living free again, to seeing the rivers running free again, and just to envision the world that we want, that we see ourselves living in and walking towards that in our every action. I really invite all of us to do that.
Thank you for sharing those words. I think what's been important to me in this whole process is if I'm reacting to what's happening and I'm in anger to what's happening, I'm not good to anyone. So it's been really important to stay humble about this whole process, and in this way it keeps me in tune to the power I have within. It can't be about reacting and being angry. It needs to be about staying grounded, and in this way I'm more level-headed and can make more sense with this whole process. So thank you.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Karen Ivanoff, cultural anthropologist for Lake Clark National Park. Karen was recorded at the Bioneers in Alaska annual conference held at UAA on October 16th. At the conference, Karen shared music and photos from Nadalton, one of the communities located closest to the proposed Pebble Mine. You can find the slideshow created by the National Park Service and the Nadalton Tribal Council on our website, alaskapublic.org. Following the slideshow and her talk entitled Dena Ena Alena, A Celebration, A Window into Dena Ena Culture, Karen responded to questions from the audience along with Tim Myers, owner of Myers Farm in Bethel, Alaska. Make sure to tune into Addressing Alaskans next week to hear Tim's keynote address on sustainable agriculture in rural Alaska. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.